Chapter 22. There's a point after which one cannot possibly continue doing complicated things like thinking and keeping one's eyes open. Blackness ensues, and everything stops until the body or the mind is ready to function again. The blackness came for me, and I welcomed it. When I started to wake up, I smelled motor oil. That in itself boded ill. I was seated upright, with an upright metal beam pressed into my back. I felt something constricting my wrists and my ankles. Duct tape, still, perhaps. There was a cold concrete floor beneath me. I was aching everywhere and stiff, but there was something soft over me. A blanket, maybe. I wasn't as cold as I might have been. My first emotion was a vague surprise that I was still alive. The second was a cold, nasty little shiver. I was a prisoner. And as long as I was, survival was by no means certain. First things first, then. Make it certain. Find out where I was, devise a plan, and get my skinny wizard ass out of there. After all, it would have been a real pity to die when I finally put the tabs on who had gotten me into this mess, as well as who was responsible for the recent killings that couldn't be attributed to McFinn, and probably who had set him up as well. To that end, I opened my eyes and tried to get a look at my surroundings. I was in the enemy's stronghold, the Full Moon Garage. It was dim inside, and from what I could see, it was still raining without. There was a dirty but warm blanket over me, which came as something of a surprise. There was also a little stand with a mostly empty plastic bag of what I took to be blood, dripping down a plastic tube that vanished behind me, out of my sight, and presumably ended at my arm. I wiggled my feet out from beneath the blanket. My legs had been duct taped together, above and below the knee and at the ankle. My bitten foot had been wrapped in clean bandages and then covered with my bloody sock. In fact, I found a number of clean bandages on various cuts and scrapes, and I could smell, faintly, as though my nose had been given a while to get used to it, the sharp medical smell of disinfectant. I couldn't feel Murphy's sawed-through handcuffs on my wrists and found myself vaguely missing them. At least they'd been familiar, if not comfortable. So, not only was I alive, but I was in considerably better shape after presumably several hours of sleep and medical attention. But that didn't explain who had done this to me, or why. I looked around the dimness of the garage. My eyes were just now adjusting to it, but even so, there were pockets of shadows too deep to see into. An L-shaped ribbon of yellow light showed beneath the door to the manager's office, and the sound of rain on the corrugated roof was a low, soothing roar. I closed my eyes, trying to orient myself, to determine what time it was from the feel of the air and the sound of the rain. Late afternoon, early evening, I couldn't tell for sure. I coughed and found my throat dry, but functional. My hands were bound, and I didn't have any way of making a circle. Without a circle, I couldn't use any delicate magic to free myself. All I had access to was the kaboom sort of power, which, while great against nasty loop garous and other monsters, isn't much good for getting rid of several layers of duct tape resting within a half an inch of my own tender skin. Magic was out. Did I ever tell you about my dad? He was a magician. Not a wizard, mind you, but a magician, the kind you see in old-fashioned magic shows. He had a black top hat, white rabbit, basket of swords and everything. He used to travel around the country, performing for the kids and the old folks, barely making enough to scrape by. After Mom died in childbirth, Dad had the job of raising me all by himself. I guess he did the best he could. He meant well. I was real young when he died. I refused to believe Sean Zagaroth's insinuations until I had looked into them further, of a brain aneurysm. But I learned a thing or three about what he did before then. He'd named me after three magicians, after all, the first of which was Houdini himself. And one of Houdini's first rules was that the means of escape was always within your grasp. Positive attitude. It's a fact that a human being can escape from just about anything, given enough time. The only thing was, How much time did I have left? The duct tape was strong, and it was fastened tightly, but it was cheap, easy to transport, and simple to apply. Even though it was wound about me in layers and layers, it wasn't the best thing for holding people, or else the cops would use duct tape and not handcuffs or manacles. It could be beaten. So I started looking for ways to beat it. A little writhing showed me that my hands weren't fastened as tightly as they could have been. I could feel a sharp little pain in my forearm and guessed that that was from an IV. They had to loosen the tape on my arms to get the needle into my forearm. I wiggled my shoulders, which set the wounded one to aching fiercely. The tape put pressure on my wrists and tore the hair from my arm with an audible ripping sound. I clenched my teeth over this particular torment. It hurt, and it took me the best part of 10 minutes, but I got my wrists and hands free. I ditched the IV needle while I was at it, imagining some deadly fluid flowing down from the tube into my veins. Then I flexed my arms repeatedly and got them free. My fingers were numb, stiff, not really responding, but I started fumbling at the tape on my legs as best I could, trying to get tears started so I could just flex my legs and get the whole thing to go at once. It took more effort than I thought it would, but I finally flexed my legs, thankful that the jumpsuit kept me from losing strips of hair from my thighs and calves, if not from my ankles. My legs were much stronger than my arms, so snapping the layers of duct tape on them was a lot simpler and quicker. Just not simple or quick enough. Before I'd gotten out of the last loop of duct tape, there was a click-clack, and the office door swung open, accompanied by the murmur of low voices and the tinny din of old-time rock and roll music. I panicked. I couldn't run. My ankles were still bound. By the time I got free and struggled to my feet, they'd be on me. So I did the next best thing. I whipped the blanket up and over me, snaked my hands behind the pole, grabbed the IV needle as I went, and concealed it in my hand, and bent my head forward as though I were asleep.
"I still don't see why we just don't put a bullet in him and dump him,"
said the harsh voice with no nasal tone at all, flat nose. "Stupid," Parker growled, his voice like sandpaper. "One, we don't do it without having the others here to see, and two, we don't do it until Marconi's had a chance to see him."
"Marcone?" Flatnose said, with a sneer in his voice. "What's he want with him?"
"Good question," I thought. I kept my head down, my body relaxed, and tried to think sleepy thoughts. Marconi was coming here? "Who cares?" Parker answered. "I made sure he'd live through the day. Either way, I want him here tonight. No skin off my teeth." Flatnose grunted.
"Chicago sees a lot of mobsters. Marconi's just one more. But one call from him and this wizard character gets to reprieve. Who is this guy, huh? The freaking governor?"
"Always thinking with your balls," Parker said, his voice calm. "Marconi isn't just a mobster. Running Chicago is just his sideline, see? He's got business all over the country, and he owns people from here to the governor's mansion, to Washington and back. He's got more money than God. He can set us up, take us out, have the police on our ass anytime he wants. You don't screw with someone like that lightly." There was a pause, and then Flatnose said,
"Maybe. Or maybe Lana's right. Maybe you're getting soft. Marconi isn't one of us. He doesn't give us orders. The Parker I knew 10 years ago wouldn't have thought twice of telling Marconi to fuck off."
Parker's voice became resigned.
"Don't do this, man.